to you my friend, Don G. Gates from California.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Don G., an alcoholic. You know, that staccato burst of greeting someone was telling me, the reason they had asked a couple of Californians to speak at this group was that they like to find out what is going to be happening in AA next. There seems to be a tendency to pick up the things that happen. And that particular burst is not really representative of Los Angeles AA. That comes from one of the paramilitary groups that we have out on the west side. It is enthusiastic, God knows, but it's frightening. When 3,000 people do it, yeah, I haven't heard anything since those newsreels in the 30s. Zig Pearl! Zig Pearl! Zig Pearl! I have been around and speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous, Drunk and Sober for 27 years. Because as the result of the help of you wonderful people and God, as I understand them, it wasn't necessary for me to take a drink since December 1955.
However, I did. And there's... as the result of your kind acceptance when I returned, and with God's sympathetic approval, it wasn't necessary for me to take a drink since November of 1958. But I did. I won't bother you with a further repetition of that joke. But when Click asked me, we were chatting here before the meeting, asked how long I'd been sober, and I actually didn't know. I had to stop and compute it. Because it really doesn't matter how long you've been sober if you intend to stay sober the rest of your life. But I used to count birthdays. I did. One, two, one, two, one, two. I just could not get through that third year. And I tried, you know, people tried to advise me. They would say, you have to get into the lifeblood of the program and get active. And I would drag them in ready or not. And I would still have trouble. And they would say, well, you've got to become spiritual. And I would pursue God up and down the byways of Los Angeles. And I still had trouble. And they said, you've got to get honest with yourself. And I waded up through my stream of conscience, you know, in a hip boot and a rod and reel, and I still had trouble. And then, in December 1963, I decided to quit drinking. And I haven't had any trouble since. it is virtually astonishing how long you can stay sober if you don't drink. But it is true that I continued and have spoken in AA meetings for 27 years. I never stopped speaking just because I got drunk. I felt I owed it to the newcomer. Never confuse glibness with sincerity. I attended my first AA meeting, and it was a short pitch meeting in Beverly Hills, a men's stag meeting where they pointed a finger at people. And I wasn't there to obtain sobriety. I was there to meet another member of my profession because I was looking for work. And he had rather coyly suggested that as a meeting spot. And it was a Wednesday night meeting. And I, as usual, had been drunk all weekend, but wasn't anything particularly bad. And by Monday, I had settled down. I think I was even having a touch of soup or something. By Tuesday, I had a little chilly. And the Wednesday, I really wasn't in very bad shape. I was very quick, you know, but I... And they pointed the finger and called on people to speak. And near the end of the meeting, I sat there and I was absolutely fascinated. These were the most witty, clever bunch of people I had ever seen in my life. They beat anything on television. In fact, half of them had been on television that night. And there was a great group. And about the end of the meeting, he said, "Let's see now. I don't think we've ever... We haven't heard from the young fellow with the dark black hair. That was your humble servant." That was a long time ago. And he said, "Could we hear from you?" Well, now, I am, if nothing else, a fast study. I had already gotten grasp of AA. See, I take on the coloring of any surroundings in which you place me. I have a chameleon-like ability to adapt. You throw me into jail, and I immediately become hard. A regular. Covering the ground I walk on. "Don't mess with me, screw." Terrified that somebody's going to put the arm on me, but I've been in AA now for the better part of an hour. So I could see right away that humility was the gig here. And so I got up and I gave them 5 minutes. I started with a little pathos. I touched their heart. Gave them a little laughter. Ended on a rising note of hope. And sat down. A number of them swarmed up afterwards to touch the hem of my garment. And one of them said, "You haven't spoken at the Arroyo Seco meeting recently, have you?" I had just drunk my way down from San Francisco to Los Angeles. I had no idea what the Arroyo Seco was, so I was reasonably certain I hadn't spoken there. And I said, "No, I don't believe I have." He said, "Well, I'm leading the meeting next," whatever day it was, Monday or something. He said, I wonder if you could come over and be my main speaker." And I said, "Yes, I'd be glad to. Always willing to do what I can for the poor devils crushed by the juggernaut demon rum." I stayed sober for 2 years from that point on, because if you can speak at a meeting and make two people laugh or pay attention, you'll get two invitations for the price of each pitch. In no time at all, I had an absolutely filled calendar. I stayed sober those 2 years on the thrill of applause and the novelty of a solid bowel movement. People snigger at that. But if you had suffered from that particular disorder, my first spiritual experience was a solid bowel movement. As a result of a fever I'd had in the Army, whenever I drank liquor, that's what happened. There was nothing weak about my stomach. I used to run into the John in the morning not knowing which end to point. You know, I could hit two walls simultaneously. And I know that those of you who are of a more solid variety, you may not think of that as much. You just have scars who never felt a wound. But if you did have that particular affliction, in fact, only if you did, I guess, could you ever know the sense of well-being, the sense of self-esteem, self-confidence. Verily, even that sense of manly virility that comes to one the first time he's able to break wind without fear of following through. But that alone, of course, will not guarantee eternal sobriety. After a couple of years, even the miracle of grunting becomes somewhat threadbare. And since I didn't progress beyond that, I naturally had trouble. Now, I used to make a great study of Alcoholics Anonymous. I analyzed it and tried to figure out how it worked. And the longer I have been sober, the more simplistic and self-evident it becomes. And I no longer actually have much material. Several people came up and asked me, please, not to tell my story. But I wouldn't, because not only is it terribly boring after almost three decades of repeating it, but it is also largely irrelevant. Alcoholism, in my view today, has to be the simplest, most easily recognizable and treatable disorder ever to afflict mankind. The very name gives you a strong clue as to what the trouble is. No, seriously, assume you didn't have a doctorate in psychology. What the hell do you think would cause alcoholism? Alcohol. Right. Now, this is largely a mystery still in many of the intellectual communities. You go to someone in the field and they will tell you that it is caused by bowel training, failure to close an Oedipus triangle, being an only child, a firstborn child, a lastborn child, a child caught in the middle of a large family. And an article out in Los Angeles said they thought it might be caused by smog. It drove people into the bars. The one thing that is not suspect in many quarters is booze. And yet, if booze had never been invented, if there had no alcohol had ever been invented, there would not be one alcoholic on the face of the earth classifiable as such. be a lot of strange people, perhaps. But there are plenty of strange people who are not alcoholics. Now, the reason that we spend so much time talking about our personalities is because you could say all there is to be said about alcoholism in about 2 seconds. Our book says the only thing that we alcoholics have in common, one with the other, that we do not share with the rest of mankind, is the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. Other than that, nothing. There have been no new emotions invented in the last 10 million years. I have never known an AA member or an alcoholic to suffer from a single emotional disturbance that didn't inflict the rest of mankind. Did you hear our Al-Anon speaker today? Ooh, weird. I don't really, you know, I don't know how I got invited out here. I have an imp of the perverse that sits on my shoulder that mocks me and everything I do, and it regards the rest of the world in a similar way. I have never been, I've seen no evidence life is to be taken seriously. And if you don't learn to laugh at yourself, you're going to miss the greatest joke in your generation. You know, I sat here and listened to that beautiful woman talk. And it was a magnificent talk. And yet when she finished, that little voice that talks to me says, I wonder how it feels to drive a good man and 5 children almost to their death and drink. I hope most of you did catch some of the other speakers, because there is hope in this program. You were not going to get it from me, but that's not quite true. I couldn't believe the Friday night speaker. I mean, here was a man who got up and he was telling us of his love for us, how he would rather be here than anywhere else in the world. Now, God knows Omaha is beautiful. See, I am a loner, basically. That's true. I find no happiness in carnival, no joy in communion. I can blow a month's sociability at one day at a meeting like this. And here is a fellow who says he loves everyone, he wants to get to know everyone. I can say this. This I will do for you. Because while I am not a particularly outgoing or friendly, lovable type, I do care. If any of you, no matter how troubled and screwed up and sick you are, at any time of the day or night need to talk to somebody, if you will just call me during a convenient hour, I'll give you Ernie's phone number. Anybody else I haven't insulted? Oh, Brian. Brian, did you hear the Alateen? Any great? You know, that's going to be his last pitch as an Alateen. He's going to keep drinking that beer and we'll be splitting a pitch soon. It's good to see these young people coming in. Gosh, I hate to leave anybody out of now I'm in my Don Rickles bit. Wilma over here, she was responsible for the ice cream last night. And it was very much like most of the babies I work with, hard and cold. You couldn't even scrape it off. Oh, Buck, I didn't hear Buck, so I really can't say too much about him, except that he did me a disservice, unknowingly, because Ernie had mentioned that Buck had gotten up, I think he said at 6 in the morning or something, and gone running. So I can't be outdone. I'm into running, and so I got up at 6 in the morning this morning and went running. The only thing is, if you're coming from the east and you get up at 6 in the morning, that's about 8 o'clock. I'm coming from the west. I got up at 6. That's 4 in the morning. 4 in the morning. But he seems like a very nice fellow. We were talking about how we watch these changes, such as this welcome and so on, and the other things that seem to have been imported from the west. And we disapproved of them. We agreed we disapproved. See, I have fought every change in AA, and I have been around long enough to watch many of them. And we were agreeing, he and I, that one of the more abhorrent ones to come along, I don't know how long it was, 10, 12 years ago or so, fairly recent one, and that was the holding of hands at a meeting. No one did things like that in the days when I was a sincere slipper. Why? They did sometimes. I mean, if you would see a gentleman reach over and take some lady's hand in his and look at her, you knew there was an introduction to the program. there were great things in store for her, but suddenly, out of nowhere, came this business of grabbing hands. I would be standing in a meeting and somebody would reach out and grab my hand. Now, I have been called sir since I was 14. People do not lay their hands on me. And here, and I don't believe in all the years that they've been doing that I have ever stood between two ladies. Almost without exception, I'm standing between two longshoremen. You know, and they grab my hand and I think, Jesus, God, I hope they don't understand this. You know, and now it's been around so long that if I'm standing in a group and I see somebody caught out on the end, I rush over and make sure I join up so none of it runs out on the floor. But I'm still, you know, and it still causes problems, though. I'm not sold on it yet. I mean, I do it, but because invariably you have a little dispute when it starts. See, because men, when they hold hands, now I mean real men like John Wayne and I, real men hold hands with their knuckles forward. When you put out your hand to help a little lady or your child across the street, you put it out knuckle forward. Ladies and children put their hands palm forward. That means that since I always stand between two guys, whenever they say the Lord's Prayer, we get up and fence. I'll lead. And I see the ladies doing it too. You know, I'm not your mother. Put your damn. God, this must be inspirational to the newcomer. But the thing is that all of what we do from the podium in large measure is filler. Because I have already told you, I have the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. And that means I'm an alcoholic. And I will live and die with that condition. There are probably people sitting here, even in this meeting tonight, wondering if they're an alcoholic. As if what they thought about it made the slightest bit of difference. Alcoholism is an extraordinarily simple disorder. It's marked by the consumption of alcohol. And it's easy to identify them. They drink. By the way, if there is anyone here wondering if they're an alcoholic, I can give you a test. Just ask yourself this one simple question. Am I now, or have I ever been in attendance at an AA meeting? If you have been, you're an alcoholic. That's all. Non-alcoholics don't come to AA. What the hell would they come to AA for? If you're here, you're an alcoholic. That's it. Why should I lie to you? If you're an intellectual like I was when I got here, you have more drinking to do anyhow, so you might as well take a good message to jail with you. Now, an alcoholic could never possibly be confused for a social drinker, nor would he ever want to be one. The difficulty sometimes of identifying as an alcoholic is not because that is such a concept hard to grasp, it's that the non-alcoholic is a concept hard to grasp. When I sobered up, I came to the horrible discovery that all of my family were non-alcoholics, low-bottom social drunks. Social drinkers, rather. Now, I'm not proud of that fact, but this is an honest program. They are the sort of people who, when you go to their home, they will say, "Would you like a drink before dinner?" and mean it. They intend to take a drink and eat dinner right on top of it. They trapped me several times because I couldn't believe they were serious. I never wanted a drink before anything. Or, I mean, if somebody would say, "Would you like a shot while I'm mixing your drink?" Yeah, you know, but... I don't mean to say, by the way, that they only took one drink on a festive occasion. They might take two. Three, even. Then the lady's eyes would glow warmly. Their toes would beat a merry tattoo on the carpet. But if you would say, "Would you have another?" they'd say, no, I'm beginning to feel it. Think of the type of logic and reasoning that underlies a statement of that order. Here is something so vile you can scarcely get it down without hiding it in mixers that render it useless to drink. And it's so expensive, it'll damn near bankrupt you. And these people, the moment it begins to do that which God and man designed it to do, they quit. If there's any help for them, it lies outside our organization. I don't mean to be cruel about that, by the way. I know there's some Al-Anons here, and they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. But no alcoholic would ever want to change places with them. Our idea of purgatory would be an unbroken series of Sunday afternoons where you took two beers and stopped. The pounding behind the eyes, the chest beginning to move. No, we've never wanted to be social drinkers, good Lord. So alcoholism is an extraordinarily simple thing to recognize, simple to treat. Quit drinking. There's no mystery about that. Occasionally in those meetings, question and answer meetings, some shaky newcomer will raise a hand and say, "How do you really stop drinking?" You know, as if there was some kind of a magic to it. You know, as if some fairy was going to reach out and hit you with a wand. That happens down in Hollywood sometimes. but but it doesn't help with the drinking. You know, or as if some evangelist looked at me. What do you mean he looked at you? How do he look at you? You know, funny. No, I don't know funny. What do you mean funny? Funny! They're suffering the agonies of the damned and they have no words. Oh, and then sometimes they'll put their primordial grunts to music and then amplify it and play it in their rooms. I still remember what it was like to be in that. God. Oh, that's another thing about being a teenager at 15. Sex suddenly came up. Now there was a I can remember to this day my first sexual experience. I mean, there was terror. I mean, real frightening terror. And I was alone at the time, too. I'm going to stop this. But you can see why I've stayed off the circuit as much as possible. But once you get sober, if you're willing to try the program, you will get sober. You can't avoid it. That's, by the way, why people don't take the steps. They don't take the steps because they're afraid they won't work. They don't take them because they're afraid it will work. But if you stay sober, you will have to accept happiness. Now, it is not as unendurable as it might seem. I know it strikes terror into the newcomer's heart to think that he might have a life free of complaints. But you can get used to it. And it can be an exciting... by the way, I don't mean to say it will be absolutely free of pain. It won't. You are going to know moments of excruciating pain and anguish beyond anything you have never ever dreamt about drinking. Standing cold sober... People are going to do what people do. They will abandon you, reject you, turn on you. You're going to be frustrated. People are going to die. They're going to become ill. All of these things happen. This has nothing to do with alcoholism. This is the human existence. But through it all, you can know and be cheerful. And most of the time, you will live an absolutely joyous and happy life if you have the ability to go out and live free of chemical courage. See, now... A guy called me a while back. He said, I've been sober 8 or 10 years, whatever it was. He said, I don't know, it just seems kind of flat to me. He said, you seem to always have such an enthusiastic program. What do you do differently in your program than I do? And I said, I doubt I do anything differently in my program. I may live a little differently. I may do different things. I said, I want to experience everything. The thing I most abhor about my drinking is that I took priceless days and threw them away. You know, we only have, how long are we allowed, roughly? 70 years, 70 and 10. Multiply that by 365. What do you get? Something like 25,000 days? If you had $25,000, I doubt you'd take them by the handful and throw them down the toilet. And you can get dollars back. But I took priceless days, weeks, months, and threw them away. Drunk, socked, locked up like an animal. Sick, wishing I was dead. Christ, the hope of dying used to keep me alive at times. Trapped in that goddamn horror of alcoholism. A game you can't win, you can't break even, you can't even get out of the game. And I threw it away. Years of it. I don't want to throw anything away now. Now, my program may not have improved that much. I may simply have aged. There aren't that many days left. Youth is hell. Youth doesn't pay any attention to that. One of my older kids said to me, you know, Dad, if I should ever die, I said, what the hell do you mean, if, punk? That's not a hypothesis, that's a reality. I see it, right? I've given up the thought of suicide. How much time would I save? I want to know it all, even the painful ones. And so I have gone out and lived. And I think that is the thing that horrifies me most when I see young people like that. I was speaking down at Norco, that's the Narcotic Rehabilitation Center outside of L.A., and here were these young guys, caged like animals, and the thought of them being in here in their youth, and then when they're out on the street, they're on the knob,
just tore me up. And I begged him. I said, please, for God's sakes, when you get out, live. Live without chemical courage. Try it all. Do her. Whatever you can think of, try it. And when you speak in an institution, there's a wall that separates the audience and the speaker. I've been on both sides, so I'm aware of it. And when I finished, you know, they went back to the ward, and I drove all the way back. I thought, oh, gee, I have no message. I can't. What the hell do I bother going? He's trying to, you know. And about a week later, I read that they had rioted and invaded the women's dormitory. And I thought, oh, I took personal credit. The next time I spoke there, I took as my message, the truth will set you free ultimately, not immediately. But if the program, as I told this fella, is not exciting enough, it is maybe because you're not living to the fullest. See, I have lived out there. I still have a zest that I just love. It has nothing to do. I used to say moderation is a rumor to me. That's not true. It is that I approach everything zestfully, and that's the way I would have it. Sober, I asked this guy, I said, did you ever learn to fly an airplane sober? He said, no. I said, hell, I went out 3 hours, soloed. So I was flying all over the damn place. And one of those types, you had to give us hum a few bars, I'll pick it up, type thing. And he said, no, I haven't done that. I said, how about scuba diving? I took my first scuba dive out in the middle of the damn Pacific Ocean. You know, a guy gave me some stuff and I dove in. Ran out of oxygen down the bottom. beautiful, all kinds of fun. I took my first parachute jump shortly before I became a grandfather. I got through male menopause by racing motorcycles in the Mojave Desert. The only copy of the big book they used to see out around Barstow. Now, there's all kinds of exciting things you can do. I had to quit smoking. I smoked 2 or 3 packs of Camels for 35 years. And the doctor gave me a mantra to repeat, emphysema. I had to quit smoking. Now, there's something, boy, if you haven't tried it. When you're ready, simplest thing you've ever done in your life. Really, it is absolutely simplicity itself when you're ready. Up until then, forget it. Don't even discuss it, and don't hang around with anybody that's doing it. I knew that I was going to die smoking. Now, my friend Chuck C. and Eddie R. and a lot of the others, they had quit. But I knew I couldn't. Couldn't. I knew I was going to die smoking. Probably take a couple of tokes posthumously. I could see him say, would you put that sucker out? We're lowering your casket lid, please. But when the time came, when it was a simple matter between choosing between smoking and breathing, simplest thing I ever did. Get down on my knees and bark like a dog for a month, but other than that, nothing. because of the smoking, and I gained some weight, I had to get into running. They said, get into running. Now, I knew that was ridiculous. By the way, a fanatic is anybody who's doing something a week before I start. Now, I have always despised running. When I was into athletics, they would make you run laps around the track if you goofed off. In the Army, they made you double time and so on. I knew that was a form of pain. There was no pleasure to be had in that. And I've known runners. I mean, I've seen them running along, even along the sides of highways, usually old men with sweatbands and gnarled, knobby knees like tree roots. And I used to look at them and think, poor devils that it should come to that. Now I'm one of them. You know, when the craze started here about 10 years ago, they used to run right in my neighborhood. They would run. No, hairy people, they were. And I would look at them and think, Jesus, I hope they don't steal anything. Now I am amazed at the distinguished ladies and gentlemen one can meet out on the street. But the thing was, when they recommended it, they didn't know how to appeal to me. They told me it was good for me. I wouldn't cross the street if I thought it was good for me. They didn't tell me that you can get high doing it. if they had said, "Don, this will make you feel good," they might have caught my attention earlier. But they didn't. But I went out, and hell, I couldn't go half a block in the condition I was in when I started. But I kept at it. Alcoholics have a thing for pain. And within a few months, I was up to 2 miles. And I came home and was starting out to go give a pitch someplace, and I caught myself skipping as I went down the walkway from my house. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I hope the neighbors didn't see that. I didn't skip as a boy. I was very old as a boy. And very young as an old man, I hope. But I realized what had happened was I had been on a run, and now that damned oxygen and those endorphins, whatever it was called, were loose in my brain, and I was high. Once I made that discovery, if 2 miles will get you high, how about 4, 8, 16? Inside of 6 months, I was running 13-mile half marathons. I had shin splints in both feet. I had bursitis of the hip, and my back went out. I didn't have a moment free from pain after I got healthy. But I kept up at it, and eventually the body rebuilds and regrows. I've run 2 marathons now, 26 milers. Isn't that astonishing for a guy who couldn't walk half a block? Honesty, however, makes me confess that if you were to see what it is that I do, you might not characterize my mode of locomotion as running. I am not swift, jogging, a trudge along the road of happy destiny. A survival shuffle, even, might be a... Back one day, I was running down by the wash where I live. My youngest son, who's never seen me drunk, and so he has no respect, you know, he said to me after, he said, "Hey, Dad, I saw you running down by the wash today." And I said, "Oh, how was that?" And he said, "Oh, my friend and I were walking to the store and we passed you." "Hey, you did not jump in. You may have kept up with me. You didn't pass me." How sharper than a serpent's tooth is the sting of an ungrateful child, I want to tell you that. I'm sorry, I let the damn time slip by and I didn't even get into... I don't know whether to talk about one thing. Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. I think in AA we share our sorrows, and we ought to share our joys too. And the leader was talking about my recent changes in the way I earn a living. 25 years ago or so, however long it's been, I went into a law firm trying to find a job. I was on probation for a felonious assault. I'd just done a little undergraduate work in a mental hospital. That was the guy who led me to the meeting, actually. It was longer ago than that now. But I went into this large law firm, and I had been around AA long enough that I now knew the wonders of it, and I didn't realize how shocking our stories are to the non-alcoholic. See, in here, we laugh at the greatest tragedy. You know, I got drunk, threw my mother-in-law down the steps. Ha, ha, ha. Being smashed up, fell after, and got a double hernia. Ha, ha. And then I was a 4-pointer straight and vomited straight up. Ha, ha. And so I was telling this guy, and he didn't seem to respond. And finally I said, "Look, I'm not asking you to recommend me to the senior partner." He said, "Recommend? Recommend? You?" He said, "No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things that you have done. When we send one member of our firm, when members of our firm go into a courtroom, the judges know that they can expect reliability and responsibility and honesty. You? I would suggest you go into the countryside and try to find honest labor for a time until your health is restored." Jesus, I walked out of there. I wanted to crawl like a serpent on the ground. I never felt a beat in my life. I wanted to rush right to the nearest bar and get smashed. And I thought, no, if I do that, SOB will be right. He'll be right. And I didn't. I went out to a clubhouse and had coffee at him. Now, about 10 or 15 years later, that guy slipped out completely. Cole Silver took off with the secretary and a lot of the company's checks, went to Europe, disgraced everybody, and died over there. Now, I'm a justice of the appellate courts. When members of that law firm walk into the courtroom where I am, you know what they do? They stand up. Now, I haven't gotten used to it yet. I really haven't. My wife, beautiful wife, just graduated from law school, and he'd been sober 15 years. And it was a charming thing. We've only been married a few years, too. My wife went to hell a few years back, and I was stuck suddenly with my teenage son, the two of us batching it together. And I would like to say that as a result of our programs, we found we could communicate on a one-to-one level, but anyone who says they can talk to their teenagers like that lies about other things, too. He lived in the front room, I lived in the back. The only time we saw each other, I would throw money in the hall, and wait until I came out. But this beautiful young lady saw fit eventually to move in where fools rush in, perhaps, but she came in and she seems to like me. She likes antiques generally. Doesn't even object to the feeling of old age creeping on her at night. But she graduated from law school, and we went up the day after I was sworn in. We went up to graduation, and she was able to introduce me. This is my husband, Justice so-and-so, second point. And when they started the program, they introduced the celebrities. I was the biggest celebrity they had. And I had never experienced anything like that. They said, "We'd like you all to welcome the Honorable Donald." I couldn't believe, the Honorable. It was like when I issued my first writ commanding the sheriff to do something. All of my life, the sheriff and his men had been commanding me. Put your hands against the wall. Empty your pockets on the hood, punk. I'd been totally honest with them about everything I had done. I should have started this earlier. It's kind of a pleasant thing to talk about. But I really had been totally honest with them. And yet, I remember during the process when I had to go through after the governor called me, you know, our governor, young Jerry, I don't know what you think about him out here, but back there we do. But whatever else you can say about him, he is a man of rare courage. But when I was in this process, after he had called me to tell me he was going to appoint me, I had to be screened by the Chief Justice and by the Attorney General and all this and that. And there was a frightening period, and letters began coming in, and one of them came from Criminal Courts Building, Office of the District Attorney. I thought, oh, damn, now it's going to blow it. I told everybody about it in the screening committee, but now it's going to come out in the newspapers. They got my rap sheet, and they're going to tell everybody about it. I opened it up, and it said, again, to the Honorable so-and-so, "Congratulations on your appointment. If I can be of any help to you in any way, please feel free to call for me. John Vandekamp, District Attorney." And I thought, now you're sucking around. Where were you 25 years ago? And I've had to use the program already in the thing. I found an oral argument. We only, in appellate court, you only sit once a month. But if you sit there listening to sound and fury while some young attorney gets up and discovers the wheel, you know, and he's playing full muni defending Dreyfus, and my prostate was beginning to act up, and I was beginning to look like Dr. Bob. And, and here came this young guy, and I mocked him. I sharp shot at him, and I mocked him, and made fun of him in front of people. And I just felt, God, I felt miserable. I swore I'd never do a thing like that. I just felt awful. I didn't know what the hell to do about it. All night it bothered me. But what in the hell? I realized the next morning what to do, and I called him. He was with the state public defender, and I managed to get down to his rank, and I got him. I got him on the phone. I said, hello, this is Justice Gates. I wanted to tell you, you wrote a beautiful brief in that appeal that you had before me yesterday, and I'm absolutely certain you would have given an equally brilliant argument if I hadn't have been rude and played the fool. But young people learn to ride bicycles, old men learn to ride the bench. And I learned a lot yesterday. I'm sorry I learned it at your expense. You know, it made his day. He was just dumbfounded. Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Judge. It may have made his career. I don't know. But that wasn't why I did it. It's because when you are wrong, you promptly admit it, no matter who the hell you are. I assure you of this, I need this program more than I've ever needed it in my life. I feel very tall tonight, but I know it's because I'm standing on the shoulders of all the AAs that have gone before me. And I don't feel guilty about success, which I used to when I was drinking. I've played the game now. I've borne the pain. I faced the villain. The only enemy I ever had in my life was me. If I ever met a person who did to me one-tenth of the things I did to myself, I'd kill him on sight. I faced him, and he was me. And then like that song, where have the heroes gone? I'll tell you where they're gone. They're in AA. I found a hero, and he too was me. God, I hope all of you stick around long enough to find the heroes that are you.